pleasure to have Dr. Richard Simon here this morning, who is the chief of the biometric research branch in the Division of Cancer Treatment and Diagnosis at NCI. He's going to talk to us about BRB array tools.
Is this working okay? Okay, I thought what I'd try to do is I thought I'd run through some slides and to talk about BRB array tools and its features, and then sort of run through a short demo. BRB array tools is some software that myself and a contractor have developed for microarray data analysis. Okay, I didn't want to make it too loud. Okay. I guess one of the things I want to present is this URL of our website, and I'm going to post these slides on that website. We have an area on the website called, I think, Technical Reports and Presentations, and there's a lot of PowerPoint presentations there. There's reprints and technical reports related to microarray data analysis. And so I would invite you to, and also that's the website where you can actually, if you don't already have it, can download the software. We've had a lot of people download the software. We're trying to assess how many active users we have. We have over 5,000 registered users, and they're all around the world. We also, for BRB Array Tools, there's a message board on that website. There's also a listserv associated with the software, and we basically look at that message board and the listserv and try to answer questions of anybody who posts a question. We also recently just initiated an archive of human tumor gene expression data with accompanying clinical and pathological data based on publications. We have about 25 data sets in that archive, and what we've done is we've taken that publicly available data, made them into BRB Array Tools projects, and including the clinical data or whatever kind of data the paper made available about those arrays, and zipped them up and put them on that website. So it makes it very easy for you to get access to some of these data sets, and very easy to start analyzing. You just sort of download it, unzip it, open it up in Excel. BRB Array Tools, when it installs on your desktop computer, it installs itself as an Excel add-in, and you're ready to use it to analyze that data then. So it's very easy. Also on the website, I had been keeping a list of microarray myths. I haven't updated it for quite a while, but that's there too. This is just a list of some publications from myself and members of my group related to microarrays, and I just included it here so that if you do take the trouble to download the presentation, you'll have a list of what I think are some relevant publications. So I think there are a lot of challenges in the use of deep microarray technology. I think design and analysis are actually bigger challenges than data management. Data management is a challenge too, but I think design and analysis today is sort of the rate limiting step in terms of using the technology to really get biological knowledge. I think there is a limited availability of experienced statistical collaborators, and there's an amazing predominance of hype, misinformation, dangerous methods promulgated both by biomedical scientists as well as professional statisticians and computer scientists. And there's also a lot of flashy software that encourages misleading analysis. So BRB Array Tools is sort of an attempt to deal with some of that, to provide biomedical scientists with access to statistical expertise embedded in software for the analysis of expression data, and to provide both the scientists and the statistical and my postdoctoral fellows and other statistical computational people who are essentially trying to learn about analysis of this kind of data, to provide them with both training in how you should analyze high-dimensional data, and sort of access to a critical assessment of methods published in a rapidly expanding literature. The literature of methods for analysis of microarray data is huge, but many of those methods are actually not very good. Some of them are actually very bad. So one of the things my group does is read a lot of these papers and come up with our view of what's good and what's not, and sort of that determines what we put into BWRA tools. BWRA tools is an integrated package. It's not just a package for one kind of analysis. Once you import your data, there's all kinds of things you can do with it, all kinds of analyses you can do. It installs itself as an add-in to Excel. We use Excel basically just for the user interface. We don't use the analysis features of Excel. The analysis features are state-of-the-art analysis methods programmed either in R, Java, or Fortran, sort of transparent to the user. The user just interacts with the BWRA tools menu, which is in Excel, and via interactions with that menu and the dialog boxes that menu brings up, it then passes the data to these other programs in the background, and the results of those analyses are presented back to the user. So the user doesn't have to worry about reformatting anything or what's going on in the background at the programming level. But a lot of the computational methods are real heavy-duty computation, and so way too much for Excel, way too much even for interpreted language like R. The data now is not stored as worksheets. In our most recent release, a 3.4 release, we've gotten rid of most of the limitations of Excel. The data is basically stored as binary files, again, transparent to the user. And so now you can easily have a project with 1,000 or more arrays and 65,000 genes per project. As long as you have enough random access memory, that should work fine in BWRA tools. And we're continuing to develop this system. It's based on continuing evaluation of new methods and the validity and usefulness of new methods. Basically, it's my personal curated system. I decide what goes in there, what I think is useful. I like to keep contact with users so I know, because there's a lot of people using arrays for all kinds of different problems, and so we try to include things that address these kinds of problems, but I decide basically personally on what methods are going to go in there. It's not a repository like Bioconductor where anybody can sort of put any kind of method they want. Some of the stuff in Bioconductor is good and some of it is really bad. So it's not just a methods repository. It is publicly available for non-commercial use for free from our website. I think I already showed this slide. I see. Okay. It's not tied to any database. We basically can import. We've built special importers for common databases and platforms like the MADB database of that the NCI uses, or commonly used image analysis programs. We've built automatic importers for the file the GenePix generates, or the Mass5 or GCOS. We can sort of have importers for cell files, and we have an import wizard basically for any file output by an image analysis program. So we didn't build this for being used at a particular place. So we wanted it to not be tied to any particular database format. So we basically import the data. It's the expression data, some kind of spotter probe set identifier. We then, once we have some identifier, we actually go to other places on the web to get additional annotation for those genes. Then there's a thing we call the experiment descriptor worksheet. This is basically something produced by the user. Each row corresponds to an array, and the columns correspond to whatever the user wants them to correspond to. The phenotypes about the arrays, which ones are tumor, which ones are normal, which ones are grade 2, which ones are grade 3. And you can use whatever kind of coding you want. It's a very flexible thing, and this experiment descriptor worksheet is what is used to drive the analyses, and I'll illustrate that a little later. And basically, the imported data is saved as a project folder containing project workbook and binary files, and that project workbook can be reopened at any time to continue doing additional analyses. And all of the outputs are saved as HTML files in an output folder. It's highly computationally efficient. The non-intensive analyses are mostly programmed in R. The intensive, which is a public domain version of S+, a good statistical programming language. And the intensive analyses are programmed in Fortran because R is far too slow for really computationally intensive analyses. For example, we reprogrammed SAM, commonly used method for class comparison, and our Fortran version is at least 9 times faster than the version either in Bioconductor or at the SAM website, and more accurate too. And BRB array tools, the other thing we've emphasized is extensive gene and pathway annotation features. I won't really have much time to go over that today. We have a plug-in facility for user-written R functions, made it easy for users to write R functions and to have them run on their data in BRB array tools, and we use that when we want to develop something very quickly. We have a message board and a listserv, and extensive built-in help facilities, including tutorials, data sets, an extensive user's guide, sample data analysis sections that users can potentially use when they're writing up their results for publication, and things like that. We have this new archive of human tumor expression data in BRB Array Tools project format, which it's an easy way to actually archive your data if you're talking about human tumor data, or to analyze someone else's data. Let's say you download it, unzip it, open an Excel, and start analyzing. Okay, extensive microarray research requires clear objectives, careful planning, and appropriate analysis. And the clear objectives, not gene-specific mechanistic hypotheses, but clear kind of objectives. And I'm going to be sort of talking about the kind of analysis tools are in BRB array tools. And these analysis tools are try to tailor them to particular study objectives. And people are using arrays for a wide variety of things, but some of the objectives either come into the category of class comparison, class prediction, or class discovery. Not all of the objectives are in these categories. Class comparison, for example, find the genes that are differentially expressed among different conditions, pre-treatment, post-treatment, or for different tissues. So finding differentially expressed genes under different conditions or different tissues, or different groups of arrays, where the grouping is based on something extrinsic to the expression data itself. And class prediction, where you're not just looking for the differentially expressed genes, you're actually looking for a prediction rule that will permit you to predict something based on an expression profile. So for example, predict the response of a patient to treatment using gene expression profile. And you develop that prediction rule by having expression profiles of, say, responders and expression profiles of non-responders. And you wanted to develop a prediction rule. And part of the process of developing that prediction rule is defining which genes to use in the prediction rule. But the basic objective here is different than here. This tends to be used in medical-related problems, and the emphasis is on prediction. This is more often used in biological problems, where the emphasis might be on understanding mechanisms. A lot of times you can actually do good prediction even though you don't understand mechanisms. understanding really how the genes, what pathways they're in, and what the mechanistic reasons for why genes are differentially expressed, a lot of times is harder than just developing a prediction rule that predicts accurately. And then the third objective here is class discovery, and that is where you don't have these extrinsic classes, but rather all you have essentially are expression profiles, and you want to say, are these homogeneous, or do the profiles themselves fall into clusters? So discover clusters of specimens or clusters of genes when you're trying to look at what genes might be in similar pathways, and looking, therefore, at clusters of genes. So I wanted to say cluster analysis is basically useful for this objective, but it's basically not very useful for these other two objectives, although it's sort of used usually inappropriately for these two objectives. The tools for this objective tend to be called unsupervised, because there's no class, there are no class groupings extrinsic external to the expression data to drive the analysis. And for these kind of analyses, for these kind of objectives, the analysis should be really driven by the class information. Here there's no class information, and so the analysis tools appropriate here are called unsupervised. They're not supervised or driven by the class variable. And so for unsupervised analysis tools, basically there's scatter plots. These are the ones that are included in BRB array tools. There's various kinds of cluster analysis. Actually, Mike Eisen's cluster and tree view programs can be accessed internally to BRB array tools. So once you import your data to BRB array tools, if you like the kind of cluster analysis and tree view looking at those clusters that those programs give you, they're available from inside BRB array tools. You don't have to reformat anything and then start using those programs. And we have our own cluster analyses. We've also included cluster stability measures and cluster reproducibility measures when you're clustering arrays. And like all of these cluster analysis programs, we have multicolored dendrograms. We also have a rotating three-dimensional principal component plot, and I'll illustrate that later, where each point represents an array, and you can spin the thing, and they're presented in, since you might have 10,000 genes or 20,000 genes, we can't sort of show the arrays in 20,000 dimensions, so you basically compute the three principal components of the genes, which represent linear combinations of the genes that express the greatest portion of the variability of the genes, and sometimes even just showing the arrays represented in those three dimensions represented by the three principal components, you can see interesting differences among the arrays. It's just an exploratory tool, but you can control the direction of spin, and you can color code the points easily with regard to some other variable like histologic type, and you can sort of brush the points with your mouse to identify how they're labeled. And another nice thing is we've programmed it so you can save this 3D rotating display as a PowerPoint presentation with the active control. So you can then show it in PowerPoint and control the direction of spin and everything. I'm going to talk a little bit here about class comparison, and I just wanted to preface it by saying class comparison, one of the reasons it's sort of tricky is if you say you have 10,000 genes and suppose you're going to compare them between two classes and you want to say which genes are differentially expressed, if you do it at a traditional 5% statistical significance level, you're going to wind up with about, on the average, 500 false positives. So the traditional sort of notion of statistical significance sort of falls apart when we start talking about analyses in which we have, you know, thousands of different variables that we're potentially interested in. So one thing you can do, the simplest thing you can do, is instead of using the 5% statistical significance threshold, you can use something much more stringent than that, and that will bring you down to about 10 false positives per 10,000 genes. So in BRB array tools, yeah. You mean why use 0.1? Oh, that, no, that, I'm just for illustration. No, there's no, in terms of BRB array tools, you can select whatever level you want. And that's just sort of, as I'm trying to show here, doing it based on this univariate statistical significance level like 0.001 is one way, one analysis, one option we give. And then in terms of univariate significance, can either be based on normal distribution assumption or based on a univariate permutation test. The other approaches that are in BRB array tools are to do what we call a multivariate permutation test that controls the false discovery rate with specified confidence. Now, the false discovery rate is sort of, when you do this analysis, say with your 10,000 genes, you're going to wind up with a list of genes that the analysis is going to say, these look like differentially expressed genes. And the false discovery rate is the proportion of those genes which are false positives, which are expected to be false positives. So rather than controlling something like statistical significance on a gene-by-gene test basis, almost now with microarray analysis, a more standard approach is to control the false discovery rate. To say, well, what we really care about is that the gene list we wind up with is not dominated by false positives. You know, if it has 5 or 10% false positives, that's probably okay. You know, we're not going to go to the patent office trying to patent these genes. We're trying to figure out what to do next with them. But we just don't want to be swamped with false positives, because then we won't be able to interpret it or know how to go forward. So we want to control this false discovery rate. We've published a paper on this method, and that's in BRB array tools, and you can also use it as a multivariate permutation test for controlling not the proportion of false discoveries in that gene list, but the number of false discoveries in that gene list. And we also have available within BRB array tools, as I mentioned, this SAM, the statistical analysis of microarrays, which is a very popular method, which is actually pretty similar to our multivariate permutation test for controlling false discovery rate. We can specify sort of control the confidence level, and you can't really do that in SAM, but other than that, in concept, they're similar. It's also easy to adjust in BRB array tools for some blocking variables. So, for example, suppose you're analyzing breast cancer samples, those who respond, respond versus those who don't respond to some therapy, and you say, well, I want to know which genes are associated with response, but I want genes that are not just related to, say, tumor grade or estrogen receptor positivity. So when you actually run this class comparison, you can say, I want you to block the analysis, stratify it by some other variable. It's sort of a way, really, of a very easy way of doing an analysis, a two-way analysis of variance, but it's very easy to do. The class comparison also identifies gene ontology categories that are it looks at the resulting gene list and looks up the geo categories for all of those genes and all of the three dimensions of gene ontology and calculates an observed and an expected for each of those gene ontology classes and say which gene ontology classes seem overrepresented in that gene list. That's not a real good way to process the geo data, as I'll mention later. This is sort of a post facto annotation using GEO, and now there are better ways of using GEO sort of prospectively and analyzing your data rather than just annotating your gene list using GEO. And we also provide a chromosome location analysis of this resulting gene list and hyperlinks to multiple genomic databases for the genes that you find significant. The gene list is saved for subsequent analysis and annotation. We also have in BRB Array Tools what we call a gene set class comparison. It's like what the Whitehead published with the, they call it gene set expression analysis. In other words, in actually analyzing for differential expression, you don't just do it on a gene-by-gene basis, but you want to find predefined gene sets which seem differentially expressed. And the gene sets we're currently set up to analyze are the gene sets that, based on the gene ontology categorizations, BioCarta pathways, KEG pathways, these broad Whitehead signatures, which sort of are automatically imported into BRB Array Tools when you ask them to, or any user-defined gene sets. And we are in the process of adding human transcription factor target gene sets for doing the same kind of an analysis. Basically, it is BRB Array Tools for this analysis tool will calculate a summary of differential expression for each gene set and then evaluate the statistical significance of that summary relative to permuting the arrays with regard to which class they're in and relative to resampling gene sets of the same number of genes, randomly resampling. I'm having to go through this stuff pretty fast, but we just don't have a whole lot of time. Gene set class comparison is really more powerful than the kind of post hoc annotation, which is common. And also, it gives a valid measure of statistical significance, whereas the usual post hoc annotation measures of statistical significance that are usually quoted are not really valid. I won't go through this. We have various analysis of various variance tools in BRB Array Tools. And then we have class prediction tools. And as I mentioned, basically you want to predict something like who's going to respond or who's going to have toxicity based on expression profiles. One of the most commonly misused things about clustering is to try to use cluster analysis for a class prediction problem. And usually what's done is genes are selected based on a class comparison, and then the samples are clustered with regard to those genes. And then the fact that the samples sort of separate in the dendrogram is taken as evidence that you can sort of predict based on those genes. But you've already used the same set of data for deriving which genes are differentially expressed. So I'm not going to have time to go through it, but it's basically a completely invalid analysis. And class prediction analysis should be a supervised kind of analysis. It really doesn't use clustering. So the basic paradigm is you select the genes to be included in the predictive model using some training data, and you build some kind of a predictive model with linear discriminant analysis, or there's a large group of classifier types that combine the expression levels of the selected genes into a classifier of the two classes or however many classes you have. And it's sort of a, you know, sort of a small industry of publishing these various kinds of classifiers. And then publishing and claiming your classifier is the greatest thing since sliced bread without really comparing it to other classifiers. And then evaluating the predictive accuracy of the model on completely independent data. It should be based, you can't evaluate the accuracy on the model really using the same data that you use to develop the model. The cleanest thing is to just have a separate data set. Often you don't have enough data to do that very efficiently, so you use things like cross-validation, where you leave out one specimen, you do the whole process of developing a classifier, selecting the genes, fitting the model, and then you evaluate whether the model predicts correctly for the specimen that was left out. And you repeat that leaving out all of the specimens one at a time and redoing each time the complete model development process, including reselecting the genes. And this is the sort of a more data efficient version of trying to separate the data used for model development from the data used for model evaluation. There's a lot of misconceptions about cross-validation. I think it can be a very effective and efficient use of the data. It's often used improperly in the literature because people don't reselect the genes for each loop of the cross-validation. BRBRA tools has a lot of classifiers built in, and so rather than sort of the literature cannot, there's a few studies that people have done that have compared different kind of classifiers, and those are useful. Very often the initial papers that are published are people pushing one classifier that they develop and they make strong claims for it, and often they don't really compare it or they don't validly compare it to other methods. So in BRBRA tools, basically you have all of these methods and you can run them all on your data, and you can run, and it'll cross-validate it, and you'll be able to get an unbiased estimate of prediction accuracy of all of these classifiers. And usually when you do that, about over 90% of the time, you find out that basically they all do about the same, that there's really not much difference in terms of their classification accuracy. Yeah?
What to do is, in a new sample, you have different
what? Different results for different classifiers. Basically, I think what you have to do is just describe what you did, and in other words, you want to be honest and say we did this, and this classifier gave this result. And I mean, even if you're not going to give the results for all of them because you don't have room to do that in the paper, I think you do have to say that you looked at a variety of them, and this is the one that seemed to give the best results. That's very unusual, though, because I've analyzed a lot of data, and if at least in BRBRA tools where you're evaluating them all the same, if you're using different people's programs to evaluate different classifiers, all bets are off, because some of these programs don't implement cross-validation properly, so you really can't trust the evaluation you get. We have a variety of sort of versions of cross-validation: split sample validation, leave one out cross-validation, K-fold cross-validation, where you don't just leave one out at a time. If you have a lot of arrays, you don't want to leave just one out at a time. It's take a long time to run the program. And repeated K-fold cross-validation, and a bootstrap resampling kind of cross-validation. And these are options in BRBRA tools, and you can sort of experiment and make sure that it sees. We've published a paper, it was in that list initially, in which we've compared a variety of those methods, and actually leave one out or 10-fold cross-validation are as good as any of them. I'm going to have to, I think, cut some of this short if I'm going to have any time to illustrate things. We also, BRBRA tools, computes a permutation test of the statistical significance of the cross-valid misclassification rate to tell you, are you really getting better than you would do just by chance? And it will do predictions for new patients for whom you don't have outcome data yet, but you have an expression profile using a classifiers that you develop. We also have a new tool that I probably won't have time to go through here, but it's survival risk group prediction for clinical studies, where you really want to use your expression data to sort of predict who's at a high risk for death or progression of disease and who's at a low risk. And your outcome data is not response, no response. It's not a binary thing. It's sort of some continuous time thing that's possibly censored because some patients are still going. So in the literature, a lot of people are trying to convert that kind of data to binary outcome data so that they can use the available methods. And there is now a small literature on how to develop survival risk groups or with basically using censored data. And we, in the new 3.4 version of BRB Array Tools, we have this type of an analysis in there. But I won't take the time to go through that. For doing the demo, I just wanted to thank Amy, acknowledge Amy Lamb and the whole BRB Array Tools development team who's actually done the development. I'm sort of the architect and decide what goes in it, and they do the actual development work. And Yingdong Zhao in the biometric research branch, who developed our archive of human tumor expression profiles. So, let me now. What I did was, rather than try to, I didn't want to take the time of showing you how to import the data. So what I did was, what we have, what I have running here is just Excel. And when you download BRB Array Tools and install it, we have an installer that installs itself. It puts in Excel a menu called BRB Array Tools. And using that menu is how you drive your analyses. And we will run some analyses using that menu. And all you have to do really is select things from that menu and the submenus that you get to it, and then fill in the dialog box that's brought up by selecting an analysis. Now, you need to be analyzing some data. So this is a I have actually imported and made a BRB Array Tools project. This is a data set for pediatric brain tumors from Scott Pomeroy at the Whitehead Institute. It's on their archive, and it's actually one of the data sets that we put on our archive and made available as a BRB Array Tools project. So, what I'm showing here is so I've opened this project workbook. And one of the worksheets of the project workbook is the experiment descriptor worksheet. And this is the thing that has one row for each array. And then the columns, which these are actually columns that I created based on the data that Scott Pomeroy made available on his on the Whitehead website for that data set. And basically, the first column is just sort of an array ID. And then the next column is a diagnosis. And for the medulloblastomas, there was a sort of a subdiagnosis, a stage, sex, male, female. So when you make up this experiment descriptor worksheet, you don't have to make up numerical codes for male or female. Any kind of coding works. You just have to spell things consistently. There are some limitations, like this age at diagnosis, 38 years, 2 months, that's a little bit too flexible, so I converted that to, I guess I didn't convert that, but for survival, I think it was a similar sort of thing, and I put it in months, and then there was a survival status, and I made up a bunch of columns for things to sort of drive the analyses that I thought I wanted to do. And in the course of your analysis, you can add columns to this experiment descriptor worksheet. And it's just an Excel worksheet. And then when you save your project, those new descriptors, new columns will always be there. For example, I felt like if I wanted to compare the rhabdos to the peanuts, so I made up a column in which it had ATRT, which was just the code they had used for rhabdo, in the ones that were rhabdos, and the peanuts in the ones that were peanuts, and blank in all of the other rows. And so that's now a column which I labeled rhabdo versus peanut, and you'll see the BRB array tools accesses these column headings when it, in these dialog boxes when I'm doing the analysis. So, for example, let me do one analysis. Suppose I want to do that just that three-dimensional, multi-dimensional scaling graph. And so when I select that, it brings up this dialog box with a whole bunch of options. It's sort of a balancing act between giving users options, and some statisticians who use BRB array tools like having these options. A lot of other people have no idea what these options mean, even though we always give defaults. In some cases, if it's really clear what you should always do, we don't make it as an option. But in some cases, it's not so clear, so we give things as options. We go to the second page of this dialog box. It says, well, what do we want to color the thing by? And I guess I ran this before, and it's remembered what I put in there. I wanted to color it by diagnosis. But if I wanted to change that, I would just sort of click on this, and it shows me basically all of those column headings of the experiment descriptor file. And I can just sort of select any other column heading that I want. For example, if I wanted to see the males in one color and the females in the other color, I'd select sex. But I'm going to keep it with that. And it permits me to name the output file. In this case, the output file is going to be a PowerPoint presentation, which it's going to create, that will have all of the information that PowerPoint needs to show this dynamic thing. And so I just say OK. And this is the display, and I can start it rotating, and you see we have different colors. Now I say, suppose I stop it, and if I want to know, well, what are these? I'm sort of colorblind myself, but I can see those are dark blue or something. What are these things? We see those are the rhabdos, and so these are. Each point is an array. Each array represents a tumor specimen from a patient. And what we've used as annotations for this column I've called diagnosis is the histological diagnosis of that tumor. And what it's displaying, it's sort of displaying each array in sort of a three-dimensional way, where each dimension is sort of a linear combination of the gene expression values, and the linear combination has been selected as these principal components, that weighting most heavily the genes that show the most variation across the set of samples. This is a non-supervised analysis, and computing these three-dimensional principal components, it does not use the diagnosis. So that's that analysis. Then a supervised analysis might be, suppose I want to do class comparison. Suppose I want to find something about what's differentially expressed between the rhabdos and the peanuts. So then I could either do it gene by gene at a time, or I could do this gene set expression comparison, and I'm going to do that. So it brings up this dialog box, the column defining the classes. Well, I want to compare the rhabdos to the peanut. So I'm going to select that. And I don't have paired samples. I don't have technical replicates that I need to average over. I haven't discussed this random variance model, but I'm going to deselect it because it's a really good idea, particularly for a situation like this where you have a small number of samples for each diagnosis, but for speed, I'm going to deselect it. And I'm going to say I want to use my gene set, I want to use pathways instead of the gene ontology groups. And I'll use this broad MIT pathways and signatures. And what do I want to call the output file? Let me just call it pathway comparison. And now I want to, let's say I'm going to look at pathways or signatures that have at least 10 genes, contain at least 10 genes that are represented on my array, and no more than 100 genes represented on my array. And then I just say, okay. So it's doing the analysis, and it's a lot of analysis, but not very many samples here, so it probably won't take very long. It looks at each of the broad whitehead gene sets. Most of those broad whitehead gene sets are actually BioCarta pathways. About 200 of them are sort of signatures that they've sort of gotten from various places in the literature. And it's done. Most BRB array tool output is presented as is shown on HTML files, and it automatically, the system opens your browser so you know when it's done and you can look at those files. And then it also saves those files in your output folder so you can do what you want with them later. And so it says, yeah, there were two classes. There were 1,951 genes. This was a fairly old data set, so it was a small array. I think this was after filtering. This was an earlier Affymetrix array. There were 124, broad MIT pathways. These are just the signatures. And it found two pathways that were differentially expressed between the rhabdos and the pnets. And these are just the pathway IDs. One's a BCL2 family and regulatory network, and I don't know what this other one is. It's just the title that the broad website provides. There's probably more documentation on that website for that pathway. This pathway had 34 genes represented on this array, and the other pathway had 19 genes. We use two different summary statistics, and we give the p-values for both of those statistics. And then what we show is, for each pathway, we show all of the genes on the pathway. And in this case, there's only two pathways. And for each gene, we show the analysis of those individual genes, the geometric mean in the rhabdos, the geometric mean of the intensities in the pnets, the fold difference, the p-value for the individual genes, and you can then get links to external annotations. We have, either by clicking on this info link, where we have actually built into BRB Array Tools some of these annotations, which we download, and that can lead you to places like, to lots of other places to get more information. For example, GeneCard. So this goes to GeneCards for that particular gene, and you can look at what GeneCard says about that gene. This is the first gene on that list of that first pathway that was differentially expressed. Or you can go to the Stanford Source Database or Gene Ontology Database or to Unigene, GenBank, LocusLink, etc.
Cross-linking to the databases for platforms other than Affymetrix. As long as you've got it, this gene annotation.
Yeah, what we do with non-Affymetrix, with Affymetrix stuff, we we get from NetAffix all of those stuff, and we actually package it with the BRBRA tools distribution for the common AFI arrays, so that you don't have to go to NetAffix or anything. For a non-common affymetrics array, when we ask you, do you want to annotate your data? And when it says yes, it actually comes to our server, and we keep the updated NetAffix annotations on our server, and we send it directly to your desktop. For the non-AFI stuff, when you first import your data, collate your data, it goes to the source database at Stanford using whatever kind of identifier you've given, whether it's a clone ID or Unigene, and it hits source with your whole array and brings back all of that stuff. And so that same info link will appear here. So when I clicked on the info, now getting those external annotations, you know, can take several minutes. But once you've got it, then you know, it's there. And so when you click on that info link, it's not actually going anywhere else. All that stuff is internal. But then when you hit these, when you click on the links from there, then it goes to those external databases. And I guess I was just going to show you the what the dialogue for the class prediction looks like. We have the PAM separately, and we have a couple of them separately, but a bunch of them we have together in this class prediction tool. And again, suppose we were trying to replace our pathologist, and we were trying to develop a classifier that distinguished rhabdo from PNET. Prediction methods. So the default is just to select all of them. And now there's several of the ones that are sort of built in here that we don't have in this tool, like PAM, random forests, top scoring pair, where we've actually used code from places like Bioconductor. And it doesn't run as fast, but it was less work for us. So we have those implemented as sort of separate. Well, PAM, I guess, is implemented separately also because the way it does feature gene selection is different than for these other methods. And again, I'll deselect the random variance model. All of these methods require some gene selection step. And we can either select genes based on their individual p-values for differential expression, or we can optimize over a grid of p-values. And if we do that, each time within, you wind up doing a sort of a double loop of cross-validation, because you really should take that into account. You shouldn't do that once. You shouldn't do it separately for a bunch of p-values and then take your best result. That sort of biases the result. That's what sort of PAM does. It has sort of a tuning parameter like that, and it gives you the output for all of the values of that tuning parameter. But then if you just sort of use the one that has the lowest error rate across all of the values, the grid of tuning parameters it uses, you sort of get that's probably not an unbiased estimate of what you could expect for independent data. As an alternative to selecting genes based on individual differential expression, we do have an option here based on a paper that was published by a group in Norway for selecting the genes based on which pairs of genes work well together. And there's, I guess, the option of what kind of cross-validation do you want to use. Do you want to use leave one out? Do you want to use tenfold repeated? Do you want to use the bootstrap? Do you have a separate test set of patients that you want to predict for? Do you want to get across a statistical significance of the cross-validated prediction error, and what do you want to name the output file? So, and so we'll just go with this. And again, this will probably be reasonably fast. It's doing leave one out cross validation to get, it's done to get an estimate of the prediction error, but I did not request it to do a permutation analysis of the cross validated prediction error. Had I requested that, it would have had to have, for each random permutation of the class labels, it would have had to gone through the leave one out cross validation. So it's done. And again, there were two classes, 1,951 genes, rhabdo versus PNET. And basically what it starts off with, it gives you this table that has each of your rhabdo or PNET arrays listed in the rows. And for each classifier method, it tells you on the leave one out cross validation, say, in which this first sample was left out, how many genes were selected, 55, and did the compound covariate classifier predict correctly? Yes. Did the diagonal linear discriminant? So it tells you for each of the methods tried whether it predicted it correctly or incorrectly based on the model it built with that sample left out. And so you can sort of compare, you can compare the methods based on their prediction accuracy overall, and you see they're not that much different. The compound covariate, which is a simple method that we published some years ago, and diagonal linear discriminant analysis, which is a very similar simple method, both linear, actually do the best for this set of data, although they're probably not statistically significantly better than the others. And these are the k nearest neighbor and nearest centroid, and this is the support vector machine. So they all do pretty much, usually when there's an array that this one gets wrong, it looks like they all got it wrong. Although here, this last array, most of them got right, except k nearest centroid got it wrong. And anyway, so it gives you the cross-validated prediction accuracy of all of the methods, and then some expressing that same thing in terms of sort of sensitivity and specificity for the diagnostic. And then it actually gives you, if you analyze the genes for using all of the data with none of the samples left out, which genes would come out, would satisfy your P less than 0.001. And for each of those genes, it does tell you how many of the cross-validated training sets was that gene selected in. You can see there's this one gene that was selected in all of them, but some of the genes were only selected in like 25% or less of those training sets, those cross-validated training sets. So we call that percent cross-validation support. Yeah. That would be a new algorithm. I mean, if you then use the support column to develop a classifier, you have defined a new algorithm for developing a classifier. And in order to know whether that algorithm is good or bad, you should really cross-validate it. So you should not just sort of fit a classifier. You see, you understand what I'm saying? In other words, whenever you sort of do so, it's sort of like with PAM, it gives you the results for all of the values of its tuning parameter. You select the tuning parameter that gives you the lowest cross-validated error. Well, wait a minute, that's actually a new algorithm. That's an algorithm that uses a bunch of cross-validation prediction error results to select a classifier. So if you really want to know how that classifier would do, you should then have sort of a double loop of cross-validation. And we actually just had a paper accepted for BMC Bioinformatics on just that point. And, but anyway, so it would be a reasonable thing to do, But in order to really know how well it worked, you should probably cross-validate. Okay, that's, I think we're, that's about an hour, so I think I will stop there, and I'll hang around here a little bit. I mean, if we can, people can ask questions here if there are any questions. Otherwise, I'll hang around a little bit too. Yeah.
One question today: if many papers require that you upload your data to databases as gene expression, because is there any interface in your tools, or if you want to take, because you have to upload normalized data, and so if you want to upload your normalized data, is there any support function in your tools or
You know, I had thought in the past of creating an output from BRB Array Tools of sort of Miami-compatible data for archiving, and then, but when you really look at it, it's very hard to know what that means, Miami-compatible. And so that's sort of one reason why we created our archive. We're going to sort of write a paper trying to make the point that actually for BRB Array Tools users, unless they're requiring you to put your data on a particular archive, like the NCBI archive or the EBI archive, we would like BRB Array Tools users to be able to just archive their data as a BRB Array Tools project and have that satisfy the requirements of the journals that that require that. Now, if you wanted to sort of export it in some other way, it would be very easy to do. Basically, we have a thing. We didn't want to store the data really as a worksheet, because that would limit, that's the way we always used to do it, and that limits us in a number of columns. But for example, if you have less than 250 columns, we have a utility that's part of the utilities submenu of BRB Array Tools that will create a worksheet of your, say, normalized or unnormalized log ratios. I think it's the normalized log ratios or log intensities, if you have single channel data, as a worksheet. And you could then just save that worksheet, and it'll have a gene identifier, and you could save that worksheet as a, you know, in a separate file. And similarly, you could save your gene identifiers. Those are saved just as a worksheet, and gene annotations. So, yeah, just through using the facilities of Excel, you can probably save your data and export it to NCBI. You know, if you look at, I'm not sure exactly what EBI requires. I mean, they have this very elaborate sort of system for getting data into their archive. My impression is with NCBI, they're very nonspecific in terms of what data you can you need to put into it. So, yeah, I think the question is, there really wouldn't be any problem of getting your data out of BRB Array Tools. If there was some standard thing that were clear in terms of what really we should export to make it Miami compatible, we would build a tool for doing that. But it's really not clear.
For example, in your case, normalized data, intensity data to upload.
Yeah, that's.
As far as I can see, it's normalized log ratios.
No, we just talk about log ratio in case it's dual channel data. If it's single channel, for example, this is not log ratio data. This is log, we basically analyze log intensity data. So, yeah, when we're dealing with affymetrics data, there are no ratios. You're saying if you have a two-color array and you want to export the log, the individual channel intensity data, we have that data stored in binary files. We don't have it stored in worksheets. So right now, that data would be hard to export. If there were demand for it,
because it is BRB
sorry?
This ERP database we're talking about, is that
the archive? Do I think it's it would be acceptable? I think it actually, if you look at what's in there and how complete the projects are and how useful they are to other people compared to these other archives, I think it should be acceptable, yeah. Thank you. Sure.
I'm already user for some years, so I appreciate this. Thank you very much. It's a very good program.
Oh, thank you.
Anyway, I still have questions. One is related to this class prediction stuff. Actually, I wrote already maybe 2 years ago.
Oh, really? Okay, go ahead.
So, basically, we have some samples, and what we decided to do, so samples that we have equal number of methods that... Yes and no. We just report them as...
Say it again.
If you have sample,
yeah.
Use six techniques.
Oh, six techniques.
And
okay.
All of them has people like 0.5.
Yeah.
Oh. And I have three yes and three no. So I report them like unclassifiable sample. In paper.
Okay.
Because and also...
So how many samples do you have?
Oh, we have usually about 10% of the samples we have like this. About 10% usually give different results.
When you say different results, you mean for the different methods?
For different methods,
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this discrepancy is about 10%,
okay.
Maybe 5%.
Oh, okay.
But and also, can I ask you, actually, and you suggest to read some paper from Lustaud, from Pines.
Yeah.
It was about probability estimates for, and my question is, are you going to put this kind of probability estimates in very big, because it would be actually very useful.
The only, you know, I vaguely remember that. You mean rather than just giving,
one class
or the other class to give a probability. I thought that would be a very useful idea, but the problem is, George Wright did it with this compound covariate predictor. I'm not sure, it wasn't clear that you could do it with any of the other methods. In other words, we have nearest neighbor, so how would you do it with K nearest neighbor? How would you do it with support vector machine? So I think that's why I didn't pursue it.
Because
further. We could actually do it for we could potentially put it in for compound covariate predictor.
It's a very simple LG also.
Diagonal linear discriminant. I have to figure out how to do it with that.
Extremely interesting, because if you have for one sample the probability to be displayed.
Yeah. Okay, let me try to do this. Do you have do I have your information?
Right. I have one another question somehow related, but you partially answered already about this selection.
Do you have a blank piece of paper there?
I'm not sure, actually.
Write that down so in case I want to talk to you about it, but I think that's a good idea.
So another question is that you were answering.
Okay.
Less resistance. It's not so bad actually. More people come from Maryland.
Is about actually selection of minimal number of genes and still being good classifier.
We actually have this new thing now in there. I think it's in as a plug-in, the top scoring pair. It actually just uses one pair. And they published this method and claimed great results for it. And we have it there as a plug-in, but when I've used it, it does not give very good results. We're gonna extend it in the next version to pick the several top scoring peers.
From a practical point of view, there are a lot of people, including us, that are trying to select a minimal number of genes and transfer for another technique using like a TPCF.
I know, absolutely, yeah.
So it's not like just we need it. It's
well, that's why I
a
did
whole
the,
bunch of people.
No, I understand that. I mean, no, I've been interested in that for a long time. That's why I keep my eye out for those kind of methods. That's why we put in this top scoring pair. I don't know if you have the 3.4 version.
But remember which one
we just made that available about a week ago. But that's the one that get, now that, up until then you
go, didn't. Yeah. It didn't change very much.
That's the one that sort of got rid of the. Well, it's only in the new version, in the 3.4 version.
Okay.
But that one just uses one pair, and we're going to. They have a new publication where they use, like, you can say, use the five top pairs of genes.
Mm-hmm.
And they've published several papers now, this group at Hopkins,
mm-hmm.
claiming that they don't necessarily do better than other methods, but they can do it with a lot fewer genes.
Mm-hmm.
So I was particularly interested in that because of the RT-PCR angle. But we implemented it using their single top pair, and I've tried it on several data sets, and it doesn't look
good. You're saying pair is a, why you call it pair?
Well, because when they select the genes, they don't select them individual genes. They try to find genes that work well
up and
together.
Down, yeah.
So, in other words, genes that as a pair distinguish the classes. Huh?
Because we tried to use, I tried to use it, I selected the, I mean, it was probably from these people, yes. But they didn't suggest how to select, so what...
Oh, no, this is Geman, Don Geman at Hopkins, he's a statistician. They published several papers, he's a very good statistician.
So we tried to do these pairs and...
You look... If you might want to download the...
Do you stepwise LDA?
No.
For selecting the best pairs?
No. No, they have a different approach.
Oh, no, we did it.
Oh, you did. Oh, okay. Okay.
But I wouldn't say that I was very happy with it.
Yeah.
So...
I know, there was another... We had... Jay Lee, I don't know if you know him from University of Virginia, he's a statistician. He published a paper claiming by using stepwise, one of his stepwise regression algorithms, you could get very few genes to classify it very well. We even had him come and spend a summer mm-hmm. working with my group, and when we looked at what he was really doing, he had not evaluated it in a valid way. And when we implemented it and tried it out, it really didn't work very well. So we didn't include it in the RBMA tools.
Mm-hmm.
No, but I agree with you that that's an important issue to be able to do it with a small number of genes. I mean, right now with BRBA tools, all you have to do is make that p-value more stringent.
But it's kind of redundant. So if I have a lot of genes which are very similar in the same pathway, in the same group, so is it just because they are...
Yeah, I see. Yeah, so you're saying if you use stepwise, maybe you can... Yeah, there's a lot of ideas for how...
Actually, I don't know. I'm not a statistician. Yeah. I'm a wet lab scientist.
No, I understand.
I'm just interested in a lot, so...
So in other words,
I don't know what from theoretical point of view is better.
Well, that's a good point, though. That's an important problem. We should give more attention to that. In other words, there are various things that have been published. We have not systematically evaluated them. Like some people cluster the genes and then select representatives from each cluster.
Yeah, there is ideas. Like, yeah. From different clusters, you select do pairs, actually.
Yeah. Well, let me try to think about that. Okay. Keep in touch, yeah.
Okay, I will like to do it.
Set of 1,000 arrays.
Yeah.
We will be doing patients versus controls, male versus females, and I was just curious.
I think 1,000 gigabytes should be fine.
Okay.
What's the maximum that Windows can handle? 2 gigabytes. I suspect 1,000 would be okay, but
Okay.
Is your computer?
Yeah, I have even a 4GB laptop.
Yeah, okay. So it's possible you might need.
Do you know how long it takes?
You know, we don't have
any
higher level. I don't have good time.
Okay.
I would be very interested.
Okay, if I
yourself,
yes, yeah, I'm.
Yeah, if you have a problem with the, you know, when we made this change, we emphasized just changing the infrastructure of the program to get the stuff out of Excel, when we're storing the data. Then the question is, well, are the algorithms that we're using for analysis efficient enough to deal with that? So we don't have good evaluation algorithms. So I think you would have to use, when you have a lot of arrays, of course, when you go to cross validations, you don't want to do leave one out cross validations, but use tenfold or something like that.
Okay, I'm going to try with 100 arrays for I'll let you know.
Okay,
thank you. I'm with Yavapya. Okay. Yeah, I'm at NIMH.
Okay,
yeah.
Yeah,
okay,
okay,
thank you.
Is there a chance I could take you for coffee or for lunch?
Yeah,
but I mean, or I could take you for lunch in Bethesda. There's a nice sandwich shop, which is like that. I'm not sure.
Okay.
I wish I could do that.
You know, you could, because
still
it's unbelievable. Diet Blue has so much carbon dioxide in it that when you finish with that, you can possibly eat it.
Okay.
Actually, I lost a lot of weight.
That's what I've heard.
Not on any particular diet.
They did it at the grass.
So many people have
it.
They go and lunch with
Well, there's a good coffee shop right next door here.
This question about this VRV archive, is it a new thing? Because
it's new. It's only established over the last month. We haven't even written a paper on it yet.
I was going to try to write it accessible from the VRV site?
Yeah. Just go to the main VRV site.
Yeah.
And I think it's either accessible from the main site, or then when you click on VRV Array Tools, mm-hmm. there's a big icon there. So radar.
Then I can upload a project which I created in VRV?
Okay, so if you want to upload it, we haven't put those instructions on it yet.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, you could probably just... We haven't put that facility in it yet. But what you could do is, if you want to do that, just zip it and send the project folder to me. And with some kind of a little readme file, just sort of describe. Because when we post it, you'll look at it and see, we post the project folder, the zip project folder, and a little readme file. So we like, the user can click on a little readme file to find out what it is. And so there's no structure to the readme file. So if you want to do that, Sandy Swain did it for one of her days. Because she was getting a lot of people saying, well, I want to be able to access your data.
So research based
way to do it. If you just zip it and send it to me, we'll put it on. We haven't yet put the information on it. The license has nothing to do with whether you're in an IHR. It's just based on using it for commercial purposes. You are using it for commercial purposes. No, I mean, there's a couple few places that are. They go through the there's an IHR technology as well. So they have a different license. And users pay. They don't pay very much. They pay a one-time fee. They're entitled to all of that.
Minimizes administration.
So, when it comes to the IH, and there's a You know, it's not any.
And you can use anything you can rank order.
I mean, I think it has certain restrictions. So it's not officially public domain
to generate the gene set
software.
There's a lot of nice stuff in there.
I enjoyed this. And I'm on and off used Array Tools, and I'm a fan. So hopefully we'll get good results. I want to get you to come up to NIST and give a more general talk on your philosophy of class prediction, class discovery, and class identification, I'll get in touch with you email, but it'd probably be a good time sometime in the next couple months to up to Gator, if Gator's work. We'll buy you lunch. All right, sorry, Mark. See you guys later.
Can you load your own gene sets into human or doesn't matter?
It doesn't matter. Yeah, you mean like this gene set analysis?
The user
uses specialization to put your own gene sets in. All you have to do is this. Gene set is a file, and on each of those is just a text file. And on each of those text files, basically you need some kind of a gene descriptor. And it basically can
I'll send it off. I know what I want to tell everybody.
That you can use for your expression. You can put there. Actually, I looked at that recently because I have a postdoc who I'm having try to either capture or generate some data on transcription factor targets and make those gene sets that anybody can use. And when I looked at the user's guide, I realized the user's guide tells you sort of how to use Microsoft Notepad. But it doesn't actually give you the format for the user gene. You know, so it doesn't, if you look at the user's guide, it doesn't actually give you, so we're going to have to change that. But basically, it's just each gene set is a flat file, one row per gene, and any of you are, but whatever you have, you have to spell the, you have to have a...
It has to match one for one.
In other words, you can have multiple columns if you want to have your gene sets have multiple annotations on them, but I think you have to label, you have to have a column. Just send me an email, and I can send you a description.
We just there be a right close. It's
come a long way.
Yeah, maybe we'll reload it and play with it. But we've been playing around a lot with homemade gene sets from previous studies. So we just rank order genes, cream off of their results, and then use that as a gene set for related studies. And it's working really great. So,
how do you, is it sort of a custom array or just custom analysis?
The miners, like they have the omics, the miners.
Because I guess the issue under some of these custom arrays is normalization.
Great. Yeah. Maybe I'll invite Jeff in there.
Sure. I'm a member of the Downtown Sailing Club. The club has about 20 of them.
Wow.
They have their boats at the Museum of Industry.
It's quite a hike to get out into the open water.
I've sailed for many, many years. And I used to sail out on the open bay and go to the Eastern Shore all the time. But, you know, sailing just in the Baltimore Harbor has its own pleasure.
Sure, oh yeah. And
so, so I never actually even go beyond the bridge.
Key Bridge?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, maybe I'll see you on the water.
Yeah.
Same sort of, that trend, it's real clear.
Yeah, apparently it's a big feature of the scene.
Yeah, maybe we'll add that.
Shall I get your coffee?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I just didn't know if you had a minute to chat. I actually wanted to apologize and not getting back to you for a couple weeks or so because I didn't know whether Sophia had been finding anything either. There are a couple that I saw recently, but I guess I'm still struggling with more statistics versus computing because I had, you know, the last go-round we ended up more computing, and I did find, a couple of strong DB people that's still not coming with the science, and so I didn't know if you're interested in still talking to me, those folks, or just still hanging on to keep looking.
And it was amazing. Sometimes you'd see at the final table, most of the time.
Yep. Okay. Because there were more. And I didn't know whether you had followed up with the other guy for the fellowship or not.
No, you know, actually, after you told me what you
were what are you expecting?
I'm sorry, I didn't get back to you, but no, I think it would almost.
But I figured if he was interested, that would take off some of the edge on this. Okay. Well, there's two that I'm following up. One is not local.
I guess if you had somebody. Well, yeah, not.
I know. Well, and because we've started posting wider, and sometimes it's like.
Yeah. I was going to say, if they really were. Even if they didn't have
I've always opened
it
up.
Yeah.
I know, so I think this one comes through a couple of weeks ago.
I mean, the ideal candidate has programming and statistics background.
Yeah, she's no biology. That has statistics, and she did her PhD in computational statistics. Well, that's not quite true. She actually did perform mathematical statistics, but used some. She wrote some programs that implemented her ideas on some real data. So, I'll send it to you.
Yeah.
The other problem is there. This is a lot of times. I mean, this is really a software development project. So, a lot of statistics is not what they want. In most statisticians.
Right. Because they're users of tools more so than the builders of the tools.
I mean, personally, I find. The building of the tools at least is interesting.
And technology keeps changing, so it keeps engaged.
You know, there's some data now that really is. There's a lot of them that aren't data. The building of the tools to me.
Be creative in how you figure out your design and what you want to experience. In the whole field of human computer interaction.
I like the PRD. It's very nicely comfortable in the hands.
I'll be in touch. Nice to see you again.
Oh, good. How are you? Yo. Now, you used to be with the NMC, right? That's fine. And, when we talked, I don't know if you remember, this was probably about a year and a half ago. At that time, I was working with Steve Israel, and you had paid me for a loan, and I just gotten separated from my wife, and I really enjoyed our interaction, yours and mine. You were so responsive, and but I wound up actually not buying anymore. Finally decided everything was just too new to me, getting separated, and I would be better off sort of renting for a year. And so that's what I did. Now I'm sort of back in the market, and so I've been divorced, and my financial situation is actually a little better than it was. So I wanted to see if fill out whatever I need to fill out. And okay. I really decided I was going to make an offer or something, you know. I mean, if I had a contract accepted, then it would be different. Hello? Yeah. Hi, I was just talking.
Do you want a small cup or do you want more water?
Just small.
Double shot.
It's coming together. It's a lot of hassle, much more hassle than it was last year. I guess we sort of put it together on the fly.
You did it already once.
Yeah.
Is it this summer?
Yeah, I love it. Well, this year, last year was a 5-day course, so it's doable. This year it's 2 weeks, so we're...
That's really intensive, that's great.
It's going to be a long year.
It's all related, it's all the reality.
Yeah.
It's not also...
No, it's all data analysis. It'd be great to have sort of stuff you were talking about today.
So how many people can you interview today?
I think we're taking 20. We should get some papers.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, that's great.
I think it'll be nice. It's going to be mixed, you know, back. It's going to be covering a lot of different types of arrays, such as expression arrays I hope we're going to do some methylation arrays or some other chip arrays. I've had a fair bit of experience with CGH now, and just getting some of the methylation arrays. I haven't seen any separation. CGH is a, you know, there's different issues with different array types. And it's not all all transfer, so some ways CGH is easier, some ways it's harder.
What is array? Oligos representing
oligos
representing binding sites.
Yeah, oligos representing.
Would you like more water than this, sir?
Sure. Yeah, a little more water.
So oligos representing potential fragments that you like pull down. So they don't necessarily target the potential binding sites.
Let me put this over here.
So that fragmentation procedure actually gives you fairly moderately long fragments, you get a couple hundred base pairs. Somewhere near this.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Sometimes I wish I had laboratory access, you know, to like with this transcription factor binding site, sometimes the data you just want really, the target genes or transcription factors doesn't seem to be available. Maybe it's available, but not in the public domain.
What, so you want an array?
Well, not an array. I mean, to me, what I would think would really be useful is if you look at the expression profile of a tumor, to be able to understand what dysregulated pathways are driving the growth of that tumor. And so the question is, how can you really get at that? And so, I guess you could compare the tumor to, well, it's easy to compare tumor to other tumors, or I guess you could potentially compare the tumor to, you know, a normal tissue of the same, you know, tissue type. But even then, to try to figure out which pathways, you know, are sort of disrupted, are not so easy. So I thought, well, one way maybe would be if you could look at groups of genes that are sort of would be turned on together. Maybe that would give you more insight into pathway dysregulation.
That's what I think too. I think that's a good idea. The question is, how do you define the groups? And
yeah.
I've been thinking, I think you've been thinking the same way, is to sort of define them in terms of you've got a transcription factor up here that may or may not be involved. You've got a group of genes that are putatively, anyway, regulated by that.
Yeah.
Is this group one of the ones that, as a whole, moved?
Right.
Is that sort of what you're thinking?
And you might have to look at combinations, since expression is probably, handled by combinations of transcription
factors. Yeah, that's the catcher in their eye.
But if you knew even the definition of a target gene of a transcription factor is sort of ill-defined, but...
That's been puzzling me, too, and I don't have an answer to it. Because you don't want to try to deal with every possible combination, and you know that many of these have two or three binding sites together. Uh-huh. You know that many of the cofactors are pretty generic, so they're going to be there their level is going to fluctuate, but they're going to affect a lot of different things, the cofactors.
Maybe what you just need to do is to take the signaling pathways, take a bunch of signaling pathways, the ones that are documented to be about dysregulated in some tumors, and maybe others that might be candidates, even if they're not really documented, and dysregulate them, either by overexpressing them in some way. Maybe the way you do it may not be that matter all that much. But then that will give you a signature of a dysregulation of a pathway maybe at a certain stage. In other words, if you dysregulate the RAS pathway way high, you're going to get a certain signature. If you dysregulate it further down, you may get a different, more limited signature. So suppose you could, like the broad thing, but you could build up a more extensive set of signatures of dysregulated pathways.
I think there was a nice paper on that in Nature just last year.
Is that right? And then what you could use is use those gene sets as, then look at when you have a tumor expression profile, see whether whether it matches that in terms of trying to classify, is that tumor being driven by dysregulation pathway? Because I guess where I come to it is sort of a bias that a lot of these tumors, it's sort of the Gleevec BCR-ABL bias, that a lot of these tumors
they are tumors because initially there is just a couple of mutational events of some kind, a couple of pathways that got dysregulated, and that led to things which, and the other stuff was sort of secondary effects, all of the, but what you'd really like to do is be able to diagnose an individual tumor in terms of what are some of the original, so what are its original mutational events that dysregulate the pathways. Well, I guess you probably have a lot of stuff dysregulated by the time it becomes a clinical tumor, so it may match with a lot of pathways, but I think there's, anyway, I don't know, but right now the problem is you get all of these differentially expressed genes, and
it's too many,
and it seems like I guess I haven't been all that impressed with any of the methods available to sort those into pathways.
I've been working on something, an attempt to try to get at this. I mean, the idea is that maybe, I'm sort of an amateur biologist, so I don't really know it. Then nobody really does. But I think if you've got a bigger growth pathway group, it may take a hit, a mutational hit, in a number of different ways. Maybe that there's pick a gene that is chronically on, another repressor that's deleted or that's chronically low.
Right.
And it seems there's lots of different ways to let a pathway go abroad.
Right.
I wondered if I might look at, say, instead of looking for genes that are consistently over or under expressed between normals and the tumor, I'm looking for genes that had much higher variability in the tumor samples compared to the normals. And,
why variability? You're saying because it wouldn't be occurring in all of the genes.
Wouldn't be occurring
in all of the tumors.
But I was figuring that maybe, in maybe a quarter of the samples, these few genes would be way up relative to the normal range.
That's an interesting idea.
And, there's something there. I don't know how much, but if I actually, I got a set of inflammatory breast cancers, which I'm comparing to the remainder non-inflammatory, hodgepodge of other breast cancers. And actually that works, meaning that the genes that, you get a lot of genes with high variability. And
it's interesting, yeah.
And they tend to belong to this inflammatory breast cancer is characterized by apparent inflammation and by very rapid cell growth relative to other breast cancers, and it's almost uniformly very quickly fatal. And it turns out that you do this, do a Fisher exact kind of simple test for gene set enrichment, and all the categories come out are cell division or inflammation. And if you look at the individual. Look at the individual genes that are in those that are coming up toward half variability. A lot of them look like this. You got a sort of a normal hump, and then you got a couple of them, which is what I'm thinking. But it's not the same. You look at two genes with this same distribution. It's not the same sample as the hump.
Wait, say this. I'm sorry.
So you have two genes with high variability. They both have the same kind of density plot.
Yeah. It's not the same samples.
It's not the same samples that are.
Well, you wouldn't necessarily expect it would be. Right?
Yeah, that's
different tumors may be driven by different.
These processes tend to these genes that are misregulated tend to belong to these processes. I just did it with GoMiner.
It may be you may take two inflammatory breast cancers and they could be driven by totally different. Dysregulated pathways.
That may be. It looks. I'm not sure how much to trust this result.
Yeah. It is an interesting idea, and actually,
those genes actually would not be the genes that come up with little bitty p values, you know, when you, because they've got large variability.
Yeah, that doesn't end. So it's actually, I'm looking for some sort of test that combines these two now. So I'm thinking about.
Well, you could.
So looking for something that shifts a few of them consistently in one direction in the 6N.
Why don't you try to take a situation, say lung cancer, where you know, for example, there's a 10-15% of non-small cell lung cancers have epidermal growth factor receptor mutations that are constitutively express the kinase. EGFR, I guess, is a kinase. So if you looked at, you could, if you had expression profiles, and there may be in the public domain expression profiles of non-small cell lung cancers, and if you applied your analysis to those profiles, and it came up with genes, MEC or something like that, you know, or I don't know if MEC is what I think, if it basically came up with something that was downstream on that pathway, that would sort of be a validation of the idea. In other words, rather than talking about refining the algorithm, the method, test it in a situation where you know that there's a small percentage of the tumors.
I see what you mean. So you have some truth on the ground. Biologists have found it, but this, you know that this is the case in some people.
I mean, this came up with a couple of drugs, actually, Iressa, specifically. They did phase two trials of Iressa, and it gave very good, very impressive sort of subjective results for a small 10-15% of the patients. And actually, the FDA approved the drug based on that. But then when the very large phase three trials, the two phase three trials of 1,000 patients each, they were both totally negative.
Really? I didn't hear that.
And, this story came out about a year ago. And then there were two papers, one of which I think was in Nature and the other in New England Journal or something, from two different groups, in which one group actually took tumor samples of the patients in those phase two trials, and they found that the patients who had the good, very good subjective responses to Iressa, they found point mutations in the kinase domain of EGFR, and they didn't find them in any of the patients who didn't have the good response to that. And then there was another paper sort of confirmed that, but not in the patients from that phase three trial. So I would say, yeah, I would say these days now there's pretty good documented evidence that a small percentage of patients with non-small cell lung cancer, particularly women non-smokers, have this, they have lung cancer because of some unusual mechanism. The mechanism being a mutation. There are public domain, several public domain data sets of, in fact, we have several of them on this BOBOA tools archive, of lung cancer. They're not curated and nobody ever documented for those cases, I don't think. Whether they have EGFR mutations. So you wouldn't know really which ones have the mutations in them, but then again, your method has it.
Would be
presumably
able to identify
them. Yeah.
It would be the EGFR, the ones with those genes. It's a lot.
I think one of those data sets is from Farber and I think it was with one of the authors of the study that generated that data set, I think, was also an author of one of these two papers that identified the mutation in EGFR, I think, but I don't know if it was the same set of samples.
But, you know, I'm hoping, I'd like to go out and maybe give a talk at the Art of the Edge.
Oh, would you? Okay.
Tell me about that. Because I think it would be nice to get some feedback from,
okay,
you know, group of statisticians.
Okay, we'll just, why don't you send me a date?
Okay. Sure.
Yeah, we will. That would be great for us, too. How are things with you?
Oh.
The last time we talked, I think you were thinking about your future.
I was, yeah. I'm still thinking about my future.
Yeah, me too.
Well, to be frank, I'm not too happy with Einstein's lab. I don't know what your experience of John's been, but it's not what I expected it to
okay.
be.
Well, John and I are not the best of friends. We're not enemies, but we're not buddy.
Yeah. It's not quite what I had thought when I came in. And I'm pretty frustrated professionally. I feel like I'm not really getting to places that I've been.
What kind of an appointment do you have?
Well, for a while I was a contractor, actually. For years I was actually. My paychecks were signed by Susan through SRA. And then John had requested way back when a staff scientist, but it finally came through late last year.
Uh-huh.
So I'm now a staff scientist.
I see. But is the problem you don't have enough independence? Or?
I guess perhaps the crux of it is that I don't really share John's enthusiasm for the NCI-60 as a model system.
No.
I think it's an interesting test bed for technologies, new technologies, and I think John's capitalized on that. But I don't really believe that we're going to do systems biology on the NCI-60. That's partly a result of my experience with it. Looking at the data in great detail, it just doesn't seem to be. There's just too many differences to really make viable comparisons with any sort of statistical power. Everything is different between every pair of cell lines. If you look at the karyotypes of these cell lines, they're just. Their explosion in the spaghetti factory.
Yeah.
Bits and pieces of all types of chromosomes.
Uh-huh.
Some of them are really awful. So we really, it's very difficult to make comparisons. So I feel scientifically that it's not a system on which we're going to make great discoveries.
Mm-hmm.
At least discoveries about how cells work. So, which is more my interest. Systems biology and understanding how cells work. So that's perhaps the biggest thing.
I was real impressed. You know this BRAF story?
Yeah.
The
one that was published in Nature last year?
Yeah. And
it's funny, it was actually one of our students was working on a parallel thing, and I identified that drug and as having a significant effect.
Well, the BRAF is a gene.
Right, but the drug that they identified as well as having particularly potent for BRAF.
Oh, you mean this thing, this recent paper?
Yeah, it was again, I think it was in Nature. Again.
Okay, that was recent. Yeah, no, that, but the BRAF, that's not, what I meant the BRAF story, the story starts a little bit earlier, and the story starts actually, maybe a year and a half ago, in which the Wellcome Trust, I think, decided they were going to do a pilot project of just sequencing candidate genes from tumors. I don't think they used cell lines. I think it was more fresh human cells. And
Moraes.
Yeah. And lo and behold, they found these a single point mutation in melanomas, and then they went ahead and I guess they looked. Then they started looking at cell lines. Maybe they were originally looking at cell lines. I don't know.
I think it was tumors, and then they got interested in cell lines.
Okay, and then they looked at a couple of hundred melanoma cell lines. Anyway, they found basically through serendipity that a single point mutation that occurred in about 60% of melanomas, and that that's sort of interesting. And I think that actually is what's that kind of idea is what's driving this human tumor genome project.
What's your opinion about that?
You know, my opinion about it is I think the objective is right. That's actually a very important thing to do. Like I said, I think my bias is that every tumor has a couple of things that are originally dysregulated. And if we, and the basic reason for lack of progress in cancer treatment is we can't really identify those things. So we're doing things with all of these poor targets that are secondary and tertiary events and proliferating cell populations under selection pressure. And you wind up subsequently with, you know, karyotypes that look like spaghetti, and we would then go ahead and try to develop drugs against all of the genes that are overregulated or silenced as a result of this spaghetti, but none of that stuff is going to really lead to curative therapy because those sort of things are only represented as a proportion of the cells.
Yeah.
And so you just select out the other cells. And so if you really want to be curative, you probably have to hit the targets that were dysregulated early, because those targets are probably more likely to be represented in all of the cells.
So if you hit the cell where it's weak, you know, you want to hit, I think you want to hit where it's vulnerable and identify.
Yeah, but all of the cells, not just us. The way to overcome the resistance, I think, one aspect of the resistance is you can't just treat something that's weak in only 99% of the cells, because the tumor will get repopulated from the other 1%. So as I understand it, the objective of the Human Genome Tumor Genome Project is to do that. The thing is, I don't understand, I don't see how it could be successful. Well, there's two things. One, because these cells have so many aberrations in them, how are they going to, what are they going to, what are you going to sequence, you know? The cells are not identical with regard to their, the cells of a tumor are not identical with regard to their genomes. And with all of these big deletions and stuff, so I don't know, it seems to me it's going to be sort of hard to make sense out of that kind of data. The other thing is, is there a cheaper way of getting at the same thing by averaging, by analyzing expression profiles in a clever way?
Exactly. I think we should do a comprehensive study of cancer, but I'm thinking that the sequencing is, at the moment, anyway, way too expensive. Yeah. I think it's still about 100K a sequence. I think for 1K we could do expression array, CGH, microRNA, methylation. We could get a pretty comprehensive picture of the dynamics of that cell for 1% of the cost, and you know, throw on a SNP array and get just the haplotypes, the inherited haplotypes, not the particular mutations that have gone astray. And maybe a targeted SNP array for a particular genes. I think you could get
almost all the, you know, a lot more information.
Yeah.
That
sort of was driving my thinking about target genes of transcription factors and all of this. It sort of comes together in that, well, how do we read out from expression profiles these dysregulated pathways? Now, it may be that you can't, and that you have to do, you have to be a little bit more experimental. You have to, maybe you have to silence things. Maybe you have to interact a little bit more with the system.
Well, here's a thought. You've got a list of things that are targets. You can identify the cofactors. If there are common cofactors, those are things that you can keep track of through the gene expression profiling itself, like AP1. I think, as far as I know, you can read off AP1 pretty reliably from gene expression profiles. You can't read off whether estrogen receptor is binding its DNA, how it's activating, how a number of the other specific transcriptions. Specific transcription factors are acting, although there's a rough correlation. I mean, I looked at a number of samples and found, even though P53, as everybody knows, is only active when it's phosphorylated, there's actually a pretty good correlation. I got about a 60% correlation, 70% correlation between levels of P53 transcript and levels of its target genes, which really surprised me. I never expected it to be active. So you can get some information about that. Given that P53 is present in such low abundance anyway.
What do you mean levels of its target gene?
Levels of transcript for its target gene. So I had a whole list of known targets.
Oh, I see.
So experimentally verified targets, not just things that are...
Yeah.
That surprised me to see how good that correlation was. Uh-huh. It was a project that John was interested in, and it never got anywhere, but it's something that I thought to follow up with something. So I think it would be possible to sort of work with the specific, at least look with your specific transcription factors and the non-specific cofactors. Because those I think you might be able to identify levels of. And then say, now, which ones of these, and then the next stage would be, which ones of these are probably activators, and which ones are repressors. I still don't know myself what the statistics are. My understanding is that people are interested in the activators, but there's actually at least as many repressors, even more, than the same transcription effect in the activator ways. So that would be, I think, a way of trying to get maybe a first step toward trying to identify not just that this set of genes is upregulated or this set of genes is downregulated, but this set of genes is moving in the direction that you might expect if this transcription factor, in combination with other things, is actually pushing it.
Oh, really?
So,
you know, we were thinking, gee, this could be neat. Would, you know, we actually found a number of drugs that seemed to be particularly, you know, potentiating. I didn't like their statistics much, to be frank. I mean, I thought it was pretty crude, but it was obviously quick and dirty, and it
yeah,
did the job.
Yeah, probably none of them really much about statistics.
Yeah. It, you know, so we had a few more potential drugs that we'd identified, but was, you know, we'd also found that we've done a number of looking. We had some SNP data, comprehensive resequenced data on a number of oncogenes, a small number, about 30, and then PNCI60. Seeing whether there were any drugs that were significantly better on those cells. So we found that BRAF, RAS-RAF, was we threw everything into a bundle, and we found that there were significant associations. So, you know, we don't have the resources to do what they did in the follow-up in the models, so I don't think we would have made any paper, even if they had scooped us. But, I wanted to ask you, or maybe sometime we can talk about some of the, you talked about some of the issues of statistical significance testing and comparisons. I'm frankly, even though I'm supposed to be a statistician, I find myself pretty confused about dealing with false discovery rates in a situation where there's high correlation between the genes. And I'm very uncomfortable using the Benjamin E. Hochberg procedure out of the box, because it's, at least my understanding, I understand the derivation of the Benjamin E. Hochberg procedure. And the assumption is that the pigs are independent, and they extended it to a case where they're negatively correlated, which I'm not quite sure I understand.
I guess that's right, yeah.
I guess that makes sense.
You know, actually, now in the new version of the BRBRA tools, we do have something where we have the Benjamin E. Hochberg thing in there. Just because you're not going to do the multivariate permutation test, and you're not going to do SAM, and you just want to select your genes based on a p-value.
Yeah.
We did put in a column, I think, for the Benjamin E. Hochberg estimate of the false discovery rate. But in general, I guess I felt like the best thing to do was to do something like this multivariate permutation test, where it really...
Westphal-Young approach, you think?
No, we published a paper ourselves, Ed Korn and Lisa McShane and myself and one of the other institutes. It's sort of a generalization of the Westphal-Young.
I'm not entirely happy with Westphal-Young.
Well, Westphal-Young was, I guess, originally for the experiment-wise, you know, and so this is sort of a generalization of it, to either controlling the number of false discoveries with a specified confidence or the proportion of false discoveries.
And you've got it working with the case where they're highly correlated.
Yeah, it's basically valid under general correlation.
I'll look for that.
Yeah. I think it's on our website in the technical report section. Let me see. It was published in Journal of Statistical... In Journal of Statistical Planning and Inference, but I think that probably the technical report version of it is on our website. We actually just did a paper sort of comparing it to SAM and showing that SAM doesn't, whereas SAM supposed to be sort of, well, it's unclear. It controls something about the false discovery rate, or whether it's the expected value of the proportion of false discoveries, or whether it's some percentile. So, anyway, this was a paper sort of really trying to get at the nitty gritty of that. But what we do with the false discovery rate, or these multivariate permutation tests, they really are valid even with correlation. So, because we were sort of using a veil, I didn't pay too much attention to all of the Benjaminian.
Well, I guess with the Benjamin and Hutton, you have, seems to be the derivation, though. I mean, I don't know, I guess you're right. I guess it was something that was only valid, strictly originally, you know, with independent. You know, I'm not all overly concerned about that. You know, I mean, I basically, what I tend to do is I use a P of 001. And then I say to myself, well, how many tests did you do? It was 10,000, and I used a P of 001, and I expect about 10 false positives. And so if I've got 100 genes that came out significant, I know I'm okay. If I've got 15 genes that came out significant, then I know there's a problem. Maybe none of them are significant. But we have the other stuff, you know, to try to control things in a more statistically valid sort of way, but...
it's kind of the approach I take as well, but I've been feeling rather... I'm glad to hear you say that. Yeah. You do that too, in practice, because that's how I do. I call it, people ask me for what I've done, I say, this is a naive false discovery rate. It's just a estimate based on the number of p-values over.
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty much what the Benjamin E. Hopper is based on. It's saying, all it's saying is really, how many false discoveries, if you're going to use a threshold P of, say, 0.001, how many false discoveries do you expect? How many false positives? Well, it's 0.001 times the number of tests you did. And what is that number divided by the number of genes that you found significant at the 0.001? And that is the Benjamin-Hochberg estimated false discovery. Except instead of using 0.001, you let it vary as you go up the list. So
I guess I got disturbed. Yeah, I've been doing that, but I got disturbed when I started doing some permutation tests. Actually looking at
univariate permutations.
Permuting sample labels. So the multivariate data is gain expression data, but permuting the sample labels.
Yeah, but yeah. Go ahead.
So what intrigued me is that I started looking at the actual histograms, the p-values for the permuted data, and I was expecting to see sort of a random fluctuations around a uniform distribution. And for some data sets, but then for some other data sets, I found I'd get these huge sort of swath, like sloshing water in a barge. I'd see these huge pile-ups, the p-values, toward one end, toward the other, or sometimes in the middle.
Yeah.
And I thought, this is just weird. I mean, not just 50% over, but two or three times the expected number sloshing to one end or the other. And I thought, this is not good. And this caused me to lose a fair bit of confidence in my kind of naive approach.
Yeah. So, well, the thing is, I don't like these those permutation, univariate permutation tests.
Okay.
In other words, what I call univariate, I mean, you may have 10,000 genes, but you're using essentially a Mann-Whitney test for each gene, or a permutation T test for each gene. It's very, very different from what I'm calling a multivariate permutation test. I can say more about what I call a multivariate, but for a moment, the reason I don't like those is they're probably okay when you have enough samples, but when you have very few samples, you can't get significance at sort of the extreme levels. You know, so your power is, I think, really bad. So, because you just don't have enough time. In other words, it might be okay if you were doing things at the 0.05 level, but if you want to be generating gene lists at like the 0.01 level, you need a lot of arrays.
I sort of figure you need at least 10 and preferably at least 12.
Yeah, probably something like that. Yeah,
to get
so I guess that's probably right. Yeah, so I guess just in my own thinking about how I use BRB array tools, I never use myself the univariate permutation tests. I either use just t-tests or t-tests with this, what we call the random variance option, or I will use these
multivariate permutation test. Now, the multivariate permutation test is the following. It says, suppose I want to say that for my gene list, I want 90% probability that there are no more than 5 false discoveries in my gene list. Okay, but then let me look at permutations of the data, of the labels. And for every permutation of the label, let me calculate the p-values for all the genes, and let me keep track of the 6th smallest p-value. And so I'm going to generate the empirical distribution of the 6th smallest p-value under permutations of the labels. And now, when I actually generate my gene list from my real data, I will require, I will include genes whose p-values are smaller than the 10th percentile of the 6th smallest p-value under.
Well, that makes sense.
And that's what
addressed the concern that I had, because right. Then you're looking at, I was in fact, I guess I was sort of groping toward that same thing. I haven't formalized it the way you've just done. Well, I should actually look at how often I get p-values, you know, a pile up of p-values this big, and I'm starting to compute that
That's what I've been calling it. That's what it does. This on this paper we published.
I'm glad to hear that. That's sort of what I've been groping.
Yeah.
In an informal way.
It handles the correlations, and it and there's a way you can also if you want to control the false discovery proportion rather than the number of false discoveries. We sort of build on that. It's a little bit more ad hoc. I mean, we can't get a rigorous proof of it, whereas we can get a rigorous proof of it for controlling the number of false discoveries. This stuff tends to be so technical. He has so much symbolism. I never really.
Yeah, I find that it's very hard to get through, and I keep feeling like there must be some, you know, deep nugget of brilliance at the bottom of this, but I just can't find it. And the things that I do understand, I think, are wrong.
Well, the thing is, I don't know. If I can't really understand at least what the person is doing from the abstract, and you know, then I'm not going to read the paper.
I mean, in principle, I guess.
Is this for generating a? Is this for predictions?
This is for null distributions, for tests of significance.
And, oh.
You know, I was dissatisfied with Westfall Young, you know, a couple of years ago, because seemed to me that in many cases the estimates of variance in the null distribution for the genes that you were interested in were very much inflated.
Yeah, that's probably right.
And I thought, you know, this is in some sense penalizing, sort of giving you an artificially high.
Yeah. You mean because you've got some real ones there?
Yeah, you've got some real differences there.
But even for the process that I described,
you're stuck with the same issue.
Yeah, but there is, I've described sort of a simpler version of it. There's in that paper we described, there's a way of doing it so that you avoid the inflation. But it seemed like when the proportion of the genes that are differentially expressed is very small, this simpler approximation should
it
be
would,
okay.
Would make a lot of difference.
And the other method that avoids it is very, very computationally intensive. And so I didn't want anything like that. Is that okay?
Yeah, that's
because I didn't feel like it was important.
Well, I think that's an
issue some of the time. I don't know how much of an issue it is.
I think also, though, you can maybe go too far. I mean, you and I were sort of in this never-never land between statistics and trying to make biological sense, make biological discoveries. And I guess if you're purely a statistician, and an academic statistician, then it's, it's okay to focus on these things, but I guess I'm always trying to say, well, how important is this, and is it really going to matter enough to worry about?
Yeah. Richard, before you go, I'd like to ask you once again if you'd be willing to give a talk at our Spring Harbor course.
What's the date?
It's middle of June, so it's running June 14th through 28th. Talk on methods of experimental design would probably be toward the beginning of that. If you wanted to talk on statistical significance.
I'm going to try to cut down on my camera. Is there a way of reimbursing me for travel? Flagstaff is a place I've always wanted to visit. That's, I think, that's in June, but I think it's a little bit later. Well, Flagstaff is actually in the mountains.
Yeah?
Yeah. So that's why thought it would... I don't know, I'm getting to the point where I think about do I want to work forever? Don't want to work forever, where would I want to live? It's probably going to be hard to move forward.
I'm originally from Northern Ontario, and I don't really have any desire to return there, despite global warming. I'm actually thinking about returning to Canada. I have some interest from the University of Alberta, which is very wealthy. I think there is. I think NIH is probably not going to be it. It's just different positions. I was hoping that something would come up. I mean, I haven't been happy with my time for all since I got here. It's clear that it wasn't going to work.
Well, how would you like it to work?
I think what I'd like is to be. I mean, I like to work sort of at the, I'm not really a statistician.
Yeah.
I got into this business not because I wanted to do statistical methodology, but because I was really intrigued by genomes and trying to understand cell mechanisms. Yeah. So I'm using statistics as an effective tool. So I'd like to be working with large databases focused on particular biological problems that I elucidate using these databases. So I'm really intrigued by the things you're talking about. And that's the sort of thing I'd like to do. There's no scope for it.
Because John is more committed to the...
John is, whatever works, you know, whatever you can do with the NCI system. Okay. And also, he's in a laboratory for pharmacology, so he's got to pay his dues. And that's ultimately what the work's going for. I think if there's any value in the NCI system, it's in relation to the pharmacology.
I see. So you're saying that, yeah. Well, you know, it always seemed to me that John, I mean, I've never been in a lab before, you know, his laboratory, but it seemed to me in some ways he had a really good setup. He was this combined sort of quantitative with having laboratory resources.
Yeah, I don't actually find that. I mean, he's got resources. I think where the resources are is he's got somebody doing some drug testing. I think that's, you know, someone growing cell lines to sell them. It's not something we can really turn around, break conviction, and somebody verify. We don't have that kind of expertise.
In terms of giving a talk to Good.